the volume.
The Colin Cowherd Podcast brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any fantasy sport, there is a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Friday Morning Podcast. Lucky today, Mark Cuban, you know him as the Shark Tank investor and the owner of the Dallas Mavericks and the potential presidential candidate. Mark comes on the show two or three times a year. Feel lucky, smart, thoughtful. Mark has been much more political in the last several years, which I'm a huge fan of. When you're rich and you're a billionaire, you've got time to do, you know, the Bill Gates thing. You read a lot. You talk about big issues. And I think Mark Cuban's one of those guys that's fascinating. I think Donald Trump opened the door for celebrities to run for president. And I would be a huge fan of Mark Cuban. I don't have to agree with every candidate on every issue. I really don't. That's not how I think. I'm an independent. I go left socially, fiscally right. But I think Cuban would be a fascinating candidate if he put himself out in the fray. And he is joining us now on Friday for the Volume Colin Cowherd Podcast. So, Mark, we've talked a lot of times about different stuff, and we talk sports and business, and I'm a guy that's fascinated with business, and you know a lot more of it than I do. And you always respond to, you placate me when I email you with my stupid questions. I'm gonna throw this at you, that I'm a big fan of mobility. It's the only reason I've had success in my life. I have moved for commerce. The NBA, I am a huge proponent of player mobility. I support all players with mobility. Owners can move franchises. GMs, coaches move. Players can too. But yet you and Dirk were together 21 years. It's the greatest, longest relationship for any player and a team. Could I make the argument that player mobility, which there's less of in the NFL, is not always a good thing for your sport?
It's great for the summertime ratings. It's more difficult during the season. There's no question about it because, you know, continuity, corporate knowledge is always a good thing for a team. So there's definitely challenges there, and it creates a lot of agita as well. You know, when you have a great player, every team stresses about, and fan base stresses about, you know, will you lose them? And so, you know, the minute you find out somebody's great, you start working really hard to make them successful.
Do you use Dirk's career at all as a template for Luka? What did you learn to do and maybe not to do?
I learned a lot more what not to do, you know, and some things to do. I mean, one of the most important things is I don't think I fully appreciated Dirk while he was playing, you know, because it was all new to me and I was getting into the whole, you know, experience of having a team and enjoying it. And,
right,
you know, it was 20 years ago. And so I don't think I fully register on me just on the excellence I was seeing in front of my eyes for so many years. And I won't make that same mistake with Luka. And in terms of, you know, keeping Luka for the next 21 or actually 25 years, you know, with the way medicine and science is going, you start building those types of relationships now, because this is a relationship business. And, you know, I have to understand the goals of every player, and some I can help come true and some I can't. But, you know, the underpinning is winning. It's really hard to leave a team that is doing really well and winning.
From the outside, Mark, they look like different. I'll just throw my opinion out and you can tell me if I'm wrong. They look like different people. Luka's a little feistier. Luka was greater, younger. Luka has perhaps more domestic star appeal. That's what it looks like to me. He's a little more mature early. That's what I see. Is that harder to manage, do you think?
No, it's different simply because, you know, even when I got to the Mavs and Dirk had been a year and a half in Dallas by then, there were still language challenges for Dirk. You know, German was his first, second, and third language, and he had to learn English. He knew some from school, but he wasn't comfortable with it. He wasn't comfortable expressing himself, you know, and because of that, I think he held back, whereas Luka is completely confident. He speaks multiple languages like it's nothing. Spanish, Serbian, Slovenian, English, you know, and, you know, maybe every now and then he'll miss a word. But so that allows him to be much more confident than Dirk was. And then just generally, you know, while they both have that same burning desire to be the best, I think Luka and Dirk are similar in that where there's kids, hospitals, people in need, they both are there, right? There's no question. You don't have to ask them. You don't have to force them. They voluntarily want to help. That's a strong similarity. But I do think Luka's just a little bit more outgoing at the same age, you know, and maybe a lot of that has to do with social media. You know, who knows what Dirk would have been like if he had 10 million Instagram followers, or, you know, Dirk dancing and was on TikTok. You know, it could be a whole different ballgame, but social media definitely has an impact. Because remember, Luka was a star in Europe and he had a big following there. And so that made a big difference as well.
European players and domestic players, from a skill level, I think players tend to be a little more ahead of domestic players from a skill level. They go into those academies. I do think sometimes American players have more of a pit bull quality. They're feistier. They've had to fight their way up. This country's highly competitive with sports. Mm-hmm. Through the years, you've had hits and misses with both. Right. Compare for our audience the domestic and the international player.
I think, you know, international, because of the academies, they start young, right? And they teach you how to play basketball a certain way, because that everybody, if you show talent and size and, you know, whatever, you're going to be geared towards a team or an academy that wants to develop you for their system. And so they teach you their system early. Whereas to your point, in America, it's very Darwinian. You know, you're coming up through AAU and you're trying to, you know, get seen and you're trying to get to, you know, a college or now maybe the G League select team. And so you really have got to fight and claw on your own. And, you know, you don't typically have a full team behind you. It may just be a parent that is your driving force or somebody in the neighborhood that's supportive of you or the, you know, the Boys and Girls Club, whatever it may be, you know, but it's on the individual to really establish themselves and move up the ladder. And that's completely different.
Mark Cuban joining us on the Colin Cowherd podcast. You know, I've for years and years, and I think either an owner or an executive told me this 20, 30 years ago, that the NBA thinks of it first. Baseball makes the most money off it. The NFL sits back and usually gets it right. You guys have always been the progressive league. You come up with stuff first. The late David Stern created a new ball. Now, nobody liked it, but nonetheless, that's the NBA.
I got one over there. Where is it? It's over there because I went to a drawer because I kept one as a as memorabilia, right? They were awful, awful.
Yeah. It would help if he asked the stars before he, you know, brings in a new ball. The next time you're watching basketball, I've got the perfect way for you to get in on the action for free. I'm talking about NBA InPlay. Absolutely free to play on the FanDuel app and features all the fun of live betting. NBA InPlay turns every quarter of every game into a free contest where you can win real cash prizes. So while you're watching the game, all you have to do is predict the outcomes of plays and game props before they happen to claim your share of the prize pool. Best of all, a new contest starts every quarter of every game, giving you even more ways to win. FanDuel is the exclusive home for NBA InPlay, so the action is always available right at your fingertips on the FanDuel app. The app is easy to use. It takes less than 2 minutes to sign up. I did it. It's a breeze. And it doesn't matter where you live or where you're traveling to, because NBA InPlay is available in every state. Don't miss your shot. Get in the game and download the FanDuel app to start playing NBA InPlay today. Yeah, you know, it's funny about that. I was on Bill Maher's show, and I remember he asked me a question about this, and I said, every sport asks something of us. I said, baseball asks us to be patient. There's no clock. Football asks us to understand there's a regulated level of violence. It can get kind of ugly. And basketball occasionally asks us that its African-American stars may have an opinion outside of sports. Olympics has also asked us that. I'm incredibly comfortable with that. I had a European mother. You know, my dad was, I thought, pretty smart, progressive person. Are you ever bothered by the vile nature of your, not Instagram, Twitter and social media? And sometimes you feel like your anthem. You did it. Nobody talked about it. Then it comes out.
Yeah.
And then it comes out. And the people attack you on social media. And I don't know if you feel this way, but I almost feel like sometimes as a corporation, you feel a necessity to soothe the social media masses. How do you view it as somebody that's so clever and smart on social media?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm clever and smart on social media, but, you know, I'm like everybody else, particularly since I'm so competitive. My first reaction is fight back, right? You don't know, da-da-da-da-da. I can't tell you how many tweets that I came like this close to hitting the tweet button, right? And moving the mouse and then thought better of it. Probably 99.99% of my tweets in those types of situations. And I just, and I say it to other people as well, Twitter's not real world, you know? And I never look at Instagram comments, you know, or at least not past the first five. And yeah. So you can't look at Twitter as being the real world because it would be so disappointing and so, you know, disgusting to think of that. You know, and so I look at it, some of it I'll read, but what if it's really controversial, I'll typically just not look at all.
You know, somebody gave me great advice once, Mark, on it. He said, play offense, is that give content, be witty, be smart, don't defend yourself, be offensive. It's like the NBA today. Zion and Luka are not yet great defenders. Who cares? They drop 28 and we can't stop watching them.
Right. No, absolutely. And it's entertainment at the end of the day, and it's player-driven entertainment. But, you know, when it comes to social media, you know, I try to be coy in how I play defense, right? So the most vile comments about me when I do look, I'll like it. I'll hit the red, you know, I'll hit the heart. and then it turns out I started getting people who followed me who would just look to see what I liked and just crack up over it. You know, because it would be like Cuban, you da 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 da, like, you know, Cuban, you idiot, da 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 da, like, you know. And so that's kind of my way of just saying, you know what, you know, take this one.
I had to officiate, Mark, during college to pay for my college. I got $8 to officiate intramural games.
Uh-huh.
So I did about 7 a night. My parents were divorced. And so I am a defender of officials. You have often been the leader of the critical voice of officiating. I saw somewhere recently you said, you know, you think it's actually getting a little bit worse. And I don't know if that's true or not, but you got a front row
seat. That was last season, not this season. That was last season.
Okay. But let me ask you, why? Why? Why would it get worse? Everything else in the world slightly getting better. Why would it get worse?
You're trying to get me in trouble again. I'll repeat what I've said before, right? Effectively, I don't have a problem with the officials, right? They're doing the best they can, especially this year. You haven't heard me say a word this year because officials have got it really rough. They really, really do. I mean, traveling with the team, you're stuck in your hotel, you're quarantined continuously. You can't really have any outside interactions with anybody else. You can't even take a walk in some situations. And so it's really, really difficult for them. So I might yell at them some at the game, but they'll see me smiling as well. And I'll even say something to them during the game. Hey, I really appreciate the fact of what you guys are going through. So thanks for being here. But that's never been the problem that I've had with the officials. The problem has always been with management, you know, and I'll just give you one perfect example. If you can't become a great official in the G League, how are you going to become a great official in the NBA? And I just have never felt like we've invested enough money to train, you know, officials to become great. You know, they should be able to, they should be so good in the G League that, you know, people are like wondering, wow, the officiating in the G League is phenomenal, right? Get these guys up to the NBA because that's really where we need to train them. And for a long time, we didn't start training them really until they made it to the NBA. You know, we took the best of the G League, gave him some support down there, but I think it was like one person, you know? And so that's all changed over the past 12 months. And so we'll see what happens, but, you know, as into it, and when it's funny, like when I played in leagues or whatever, never at a high level, but playing, I never got mad at the officials, but it's just, you know, during the game, sometimes I feel so helpless because I have no control whatsoever. So rather than yelling at the players, I yell at the refs.
You know, it's interesting. You and Steve Ballmer, people who made lots of money in technology, it used to be that owners of sports franchises were often real estate people. George Steinbrenner made it in shipping. Larry Miller of the Jazz in car dealerships. Now, increasingly, with the uber wealth of young people and technology, that's where ownership is going. Give me a similarity and a dissimilarity in the tech world to pro sports. If a young tech guy was going to, or woman was going to buy a team, you'd say, okay, this is where tech is going to help you as a pro sports owner. And this is where it's going to be a liability.
Well, now, as of now, put aside when I came into league, now artificial intelligence, right? So if you understand AI and you understand computer vision and you're able to deal with pose estimation and, you know, the all the different elements that go into that, you're going to have an advantage because that's where analytics is going. If you are a healthcare tech entrepreneur and you're able and you have an advanced knowledge of healthcare science and technology, you're going to have an advantage. And so those are the two places. But part three of that is, you know, anybody who gets to the level of success where they can just write a check for a team, you know, multi-billion, you have an arrogance about you. And I remember coming into the league thinking they have no, you know, thinking of the other owners, they have no idea. I'm just going to just, you know, tear it apart. And the reality is they're smart and, you know, there's no circumventing the salary cap. There's no working around this. There's no work. It's all been tried before. And it doesn't work. And so you really realize just how neutralized you are and how fair it is from that perspective.
Who was the first owner that taught you something when you came into the NBA that you really thought?
Jerry Buss.
Wow, that's great. And what was it, Mark?
He told me, you know what, they used to give me hell. He gave me the example of when he gave Magic Johnson the $25 million, you know, 25-year, million-dollar-a-year contract. And he said, the whole league hated me. Stick to your guns. You know, stand up. Don't let them, you know, get you down. Because literally, I'd go into meetings, and there was one owner, you know, he's long gone now, but he was like, you shut the F up, you MMF this, MFF this. You've not done nothing for this league. Why are you even speaking? I don't want to see your face, all this kind of stuff. And David Stern stood up for me and told him to quiet down. But I'm like, I don't care. And then I got his name wrong when I responded to him. I got his name wrong. And so, you know, it just is what it is. And it's changed a lot and it's changed for the better. It's great having Steve. It's great having Wick. It's great having, you know, Ryan from Qualtrics, that's the new owner of the Jazz, who's super smart. But you know what's interesting? And it's just when you look back at almost happens all the time. When somebody, for whatever reason, when there's a new owner of the team's always good, right? You look at the Jazz this year, you go back over, you know, when I first bought the team, we were awful. And then the next year we were good. You know, teams, owners are really bad at picking when to sell teams, you know, in terms of winning and losing, because, you know, just go down the Celtics, right? Struggling. And then 2008, they win, right? I guess Mickey was around for the Heat, but it just over and over again, you know, it just happens that when a new owner comes in, that's when the team's going to be good. So I'm vetoing all new ownership groups.
Hey, let me throw a theory at you why that's true. Because most of you are very smart and very distracted. In the first year to two of ownership, you're all in on your team. And then it becomes an old toy 2 years later when you buy another company.
No. Because this is the only business, and you and I have talked about this before, where if you do really, really well, they throw a parade. You know, it doesn't matter how many cars Tesla ships, doesn't matter how big a quarter Google has or Facebook or Apple has. Nobody's throwing a parade in Cupertino for Apple, you know? But, you know, whoever wins, that city is just on fire, and particularly now, you really need it, right? You know, and so it's completely different, and you can't get disconnected from it, or you know, it just doesn't work.
Mark Cuban joining us, owner of the Mavs. I'm a proponent of sports betting. I used to live in Vegas. This network is sponsored by FanDuel. So there's also, right now, there's I just read the other day, a bill in Texas legislature that allows pro sports franchises like the Mavs to be licensed sportsbook operators. There is some skepticism in the Texas GOP. Why is there resistance, in your opinion?
It's not big enough. Dan Patrick was very clear, Lieutenant Governor, when he said that it would raise $150 million, I think he said, for the entire state, which is about 2 seconds of one day of the Texas state budget. And so we need to think a lot bigger to have a lot of impact, and not just in the big cities where there's sports teams, but in the little towns as well. We need to think about every Texan and what it means to them, and find a way to make it, you know, a winning set of circumstances for everybody.
Do Texas politics ever frustrate you?
No, because I typically stay away from localized politics. I mean, look, when I got involved in national politics, that was aberrational for me. And it was only for one obvious reason, right, that we've talked about. But now you're going to see me fade away from all that. I really, you know, I might get involved if there's causes, whether it's, you know, dealing with new technologies or things that I can have impact on, like low-cost drugs and things I'm working on. But other than that, I stay away from local politics in particular.
I've always thought politics discourages many of the smartest people in the country. You know, Barack Obama was largely stifled by Mitch McConnell, all of his ideas. And I think obviously the smartest people are looking for paths in which their ideas can come to fruition.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you're built for politics. You certainly have.
No.
Not, first of all, you're not conciliatory. It's not in your DNA.
No.
And frankly, you'd be dealing often with very average people that would have leverage and power over you. And I think it would be a losing combination for your personality. That's just my take, your thoughts.
I don't disagree at all. You know, I mean, I'd be combative. We got to get this done, find a way, you know, entrepreneurial. It'd be very difficult for me to just sit down in front of somebody that I didn't respect and try to get their vote, you know, to get something passed. And so you're right. I'm not built for politics in a traditional way at all.
Okay, you've become a noted proponent of NBA Top Shot. I heard about this 2 days ago. It's a blockchain-based platform, allows people to buy and sell numbered versions of video highlights called moments. Now, this is very complicated. I'm a simple guy in his
50s. It's not.
Okay, for a layman mark like me,
okay,
why are you a believer in this?
Okay, I just happen to have this here. See this? This is my favorite basketball card. It's John Brisker from the Pittsburgh Condors.
Right? I remember John Briscoe.
And it's my favorite because I grew up in Pittsburgh, one, and went to some Condors game when I was a kid. But two, he became a mercenary in Africa and got killed being a mercenary in
That's
Africa,
right.
Right. So, but if you look at this card, yeah, I can hold it and touch it, but you can get this picture online. You can get all the data that's on the back online. There's nothing unique about it that couldn't be recreated and printed out. But as a collector, I have a sense of ownership. The thing about Top Shots is it's a digital version of this, including video. But what makes it cool is that it gives you a sense of ownership, you know. And if you think about Gen Z today, the things that are most valuable to them after a car, a house, and maybe some clothes, it's all digital. They value digital items more than anything. And the idea of valuing a digital video that can be tokenized and put on a smart contract on the blockchain, which makes it unique, well, that gives them the sense of ownership and allows it to be bought and sold. But what really makes it special, if I were to go sell, and it'll never happen, my John Brisker, I have to get it graded. Then I have to package it into a case, right? Then I have to ship it. Maybe I find a buyer on eBay. Then I have to hope they get it right. Then I have to hope I get paid and everything works out. In the digitized version of this, let's just say there's a Top Shots John Brisker video moment of him dunking on David Thompson.
Right.
And so if I want to buy or sell it, I go into the marketplace on Top Shots and it takes 2 seconds and it's done. And I, because there's a marketplace there, I can walk in at any time and see the actual value. I can list it. Anybody can buy it. And so all the hassles of dealing with physical goods are gone when you deal with the digital version. And the only bridge to cross is that sense of ownership that people are used to having with physical cards and collectibles. But for young kids, that was never there, right? It's more like my son, I don't have to convince him that Top Shots have value. I have to convince him that dealing with baseball cards and basketball cards has value because it's a hassle. He just brings it up on his browser, on his PC, and it's easy. He can deal with it for as long or short as he wants. Having to make him clean up his cards and deal with them and then go on eBay or wherever to find the value and to mark them and to case them, that's way too much hassle.
That's great. Mark Cuban joining us. So I've been investing in the market. Speaking of the marketplace, I've been in the market since 1989. My dad was an investor. I dollar cost average. I have a few companies. You know, I'm unsophisticated.
Why are you still working if it's been since 1989? Well, you should be on an island somewhere.
No, I actually like working. And I've said that. I've done well for myself. I love what I do. I'm very fortunate.
Good.
I defended the retail trader. And for those listening, kind of the uninitiated here, the retail trader is the little guy. It's me. And then you have, I mean, you know, I'm put my dollar cost averaging in every month for 30 years. I'm interested because though I do feel you've always been one of the rare billionaire voices of the people, you are also a whale. You are also somebody that can move a market with a single comment. The reason I defended the retail trader was not only because I am one, but because I feel the market has been manipulated by the big guys forever.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Since the 70s and 80s, my dad talked about it.
Forever, since the 20s.
So your takeaway on this whole Robinhood GameStop thing was what?
So put aside Robinhood, because that's a different beast and a different issue. But you're right. I mean, look, people argued that all these people on Wall Street bets, the small individual trader, not all of them were small, but the individual trader, they're just stupid, right? They can't possibly understand what's going on. But if you look at what happens traditionally in stock markets, you typically have an analyst who works for a big brokerage firm that has millions of customers, and they come out with a buy and a price target, right? Here, I think this stock is going to be worth 50% more within 12 months. And then all of a sudden the stock goes up because all the customers of that brokerage firm bought because the price is below that price target.
Right.
The exact same thing happens on Wall Street bets, right? Only instead of it being some formal analyst that works for a huge brokerage firm, it's a bunch of people actually doing the work and digging in and trying to understand stocks and making recommendations at one level, right? Those are the people who are trying to trade on fundamentals. And everybody else is a momentum trader. Now, you have to ask yourself, are there momentum traders in traditional Wall Street? Yes, they're called technical traders. They could tell you anything about the stock. All they know is because it's going up, all their numbers are telling them it's probably going to keep on going up some more until it gets into some different trends, heads and shoulders, or, you know, and tails and all this other stuff, right? And so there's absolutely no difference. It's just that now you've got a bunch of small traders working together and gaining the leverage of working together. And that gives them, in a lot of cases, even more leverage and more power. And so today you saw, GameStop go up again.
Yeah.
You know? And so this isn't about value. This isn't about value. This isn't about fundamentals. Because let's talk about fundamentals, right? Apple Computer. Up until a couple of years ago, Apple Computer was considered a cyclical stock. And everybody traded as a cyclical stock, which meant it had a price earnings ratio of 12, 13, 14. When the stock market itself, the S&P, had a price earnings ratio of 15, 16, 17. And people would say, you shouldn't consider this a cyclical. You should consider this a growth stock. Then all of a sudden, more people decided it was a growth stock. So then everybody decided it was a growth stock. Nothing changed at Apple, right? It's still the same company doing the same thing. It was just a different narrative. And narratives, buy and hold, right? All the, diversification, right? All these different narratives are what they only exist for one reason, and that's to sell stocks. But when the narratives come from the big guys on Wall Street, we consider it value and we consider it fundamentally driven. Here's all you need to know is that the average holding time for a share of stock on the U.S. exchanges is less than a minute. Less than a minute, because most of the trading is done digitally and a lot of it's through high frequency trading, and they're not buying based off of fundamentals. There's no fundamental that changes in less than a minute for a stock. So it's a lot of misguided attempts to try to denigrate small traders, because these guys, by working together, A, have access to all the information everybody else does. Otherwise, it's illegal, right? It's all supposed to be public. So they all have access to the same information. Now they're just working on a coordinated basis, and they're trying to pick off some of the hedge funds because they're seeing their vulnerabilities. Just like high frequency traders have done to small minnow traders by front running them, by being able to process faster or by their order flow.
How much of your net worth, if I may ask, do you have in the market?
You know, it's crazy you ask that, because it's significant, but I've hedged all of it, basically. Because my attitude always is, how much do I need? And when things are going what I feel is too good to be true, everything's going really, really, really good. Okay, no one's ever got in trouble for taking a profit. And so I've hedged everything. I've got this thing called a tail hedge in case the market crashes. I've got these structured products, which I buy puts and sell calls and kind of protects me, but gives me a little wiggle room, you know, on all but about 5% of my positions. And a lot of those, and one of them, I finished out my, you know, it would have been 15%, but I did one today.
How about that? It's just too good right now. When I see the market going up, I will say this, my son is 14 years old. Mark, 2 years ago, I'm a believer you get information anywhere you can.
Right.
I've had tweets and emails, and I've created segments on my show. I think they're funny. Two to two and a half years ago, my son talked about a Canadian company called Shopify. I bought it at 200. Yeah, I made about six times my money. So
that's about that, right?
Sold most of it, but nonetheless, you got to take information where it comes from.
You know, Peter Lynch used to run a huge hedge fund at Fidelity, and he wrote this book and used to talk about, you know, what do you buy? What do you see in the mall? What is it that impacts your life? And that's how I explained it to my kids, because I got my 11-year-old on Robinhood, my 14-year-old on Robinhood. And, you know, you just have to explain to me why you want to buy this stock and I'll buy it for you. And they had like $100. And so, you know, we went through that whole process, and my son bought a fractional share of Sony because he thinks the new Spider-Man movie that's coming out is going to be amazing. I'm like, great. That's all we need to know.
Yeah. The other day I told my son about Intel. He goes, Dad, there's a new company, not Intel. It's what all my stuff is on my computer. I forget the name of the company. And I'm like, you know what? You're going to be just like Dad. You're going to love the market. It's fun. It's fun. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. As long as you don't get greedy, right? And as long, too many people just try to wing it, and that's where they get in trouble. Whether you're part of Wall Street Bets and it's just like, you know, like, like my son is coming up with these ideas. I'm like, where are you getting these ideas? He's like, TikTok. And I'm like, that's great, but let's talk about them, right? You don't just buy them because you got 5 or 10 different people talking about a stock on TikTok.
All right, Mark, we play rapid fire round. I'm going to ask you 10 quick questions. Here we go. The worst investor on Shark Tank is?
Kevin.
How did I know that was your answer?
Easy.
The company that makes you jealous because you wish you thought of it is?
That's a Comfy, the most successful deal on Shark Tank.
If Mark Cuban ran for president, your running mate for VP would be?
Golly, Barbara Corcoran. I don't know. I just, you know, because I haven't given these things serious thought.
That's okay. The NBA owner you admire the most is?
Herb Simon, Indiana. Yeah, Herb's just got a heart of gold. And, you know, he's been around, you know, a lot longer than me, and he keeps on learning, and he just wants to win, and he's just a good soul.
The top shot highlight, past or present, you'd buy for $1 million is?
Luka beating the Clippers.
That's nice. The player you would add to your roster, and you wouldn't have to give up anything, and you wouldn't get in any trouble for answering this question, would be?
Dirk Nowitzki, because I would get in trouble for answering that question.
You know, it's funny, before we let you go, I said this the other day. I said, you know, the NBA, boxing, international soccer, they celebrate a little bit when a player has an ego and a personality. In the NFL, they're very rigid. Mm-hmm. And in recent weeks, Deshaun Watson, Russell Wilson have voiced strong opinions. And to watch the NFL freak out, I just roll my eyes at. Is there anything the NFL does you ever think, oh, that's a good idea? And is there anything the NFL does and you ever think, oh, Lord, they got to get over it?
I think the NFL for the Super Bowl does a really, really good job of, you know, getting the commercials and making it an event. And, you know, it's less about the game than it is about the event in normal times, right? And they're just really, really, really good at that. I think they're caught in the same catch-22 right now that we all are, and that's the push-pull between streaming and linear television. But I think where they really have got to get over it is how they treat their players. You know, this is we're finding out very quickly that young kids, like my son's age, your son's age, they don't root for teams nearly as much as they root for players.
That's right.
They follow them on social media. They emulate them in different places. They play them on different games, and they know them by sight, sometimes while they're still in high school, and they're becoming brands. And that's why, you know, the NBA keeps on getting younger and the NFL keeps on getting older. And that's going to be their biggest challenge.
Mark, I love having you on the show. You make me think. One of the people I could ask a million questions to. And I know your time is incredibly valuable. You've always been such a gracious person to me. And I know you get a lot of requests. And I just want to thank you again.
Oh, no. Have me on more, Colin. I love coming on. It's always interesting.
As always, folks, you can follow us on Twitter at The Volume Sports. You can go to Instagram, The Volume Sports. Rate, review, and subscribe. We love it. We hope you enjoy it. The Volume Sports, a brand new company, and we are so happy for so many of the people. Jenkins and Jones have been unbelievable. Renee, Akib, Alex Monaco. We're making a major, major announcement in 1 week, bringing on who we think is a star and one of the smartest people I know to be a regular. And thanks again. Check us out. Spread the word.
Volume.